Alexander Overlook, condominium council, Sarah et al., Scott A. Surabell, Nathan D. Rosa, for the appellant, Joseph M. Rainsberg, for the appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, could I reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court, again, my name is Scott Surabell. I represent the appellant in this case, Pamela Uplinger. What this case, I think, presents for this court is a situation where a trial court, I think, threw out what was a perfectly good lawsuit, but got caught up in the fact that it was dealing with a pro se party who had been a serial litigant and didn't actually look very carefully at the merits of the case. If you look at the transcript, the last argument that happened, I think the appellee's argument on demur took about 3 pages of the transcript, and the court's ruling was about 2 lines. And I don't think that the allegations got taken very seriously. And in evaluating this case, I think it's important for this court to remember 3 things in terms of the prism within which you all must look at this case. Number one, this case got tossed on demur, which means that you all get to review this de novo. 7 of you sit in the same position as the trial court in this situation. No evidence got taken at all in this case in any fashion whatsoever, and no credibility determinations got made. Number two, you get to review this de novo. Number three, this case involves one of the most sacred of rights that Virginians have, and that's their right to property. And this court has made clear with regard to every single homeowners association or condo association case that when you evaluate these documents, declarations, bylaws, anything that restricts property rights, that those documents were reviewed very strictly. They're construed against associations and in favor of the free exercise of property rights. And this court, the trial court, in evaluating this case, looked at this almost completely the opposite, as if this was just some general non-stock corporation, some corporate dispute. Homeowner associations, condo associations are not that. They limit people's property rights with regard to their most important asset, their home, how they live, what they can do, how they can live, their most important investment.
Can I interrupt you with a question?
Yeah.
Did your client make in the trial court a flat-out bylaws argument, putting aside the master deed? Did she ever say, look, unanimity or not unanimity, at a minimum, a two-thirds vote needs to be conducted in order to change the essential frame of this organization? I was looking hard for that in the lower court record, and I'm struggling to find it, that it was made.
I think if you look at our reply brief, we cited several situations in Ms. Uplinger's response to the internet complaint where she specifically cited the bylaw provisions that specifically referenced unincorporated associations. So if you look at page 2 of our reply brief, in paragraphs 12 of her amended complaint, she referenced the master deed, paragraph 16.
If I can help you out there, I actually got that page in front of me, and it was very helpful in the reply brief, but I'm looking for where she made the argument to the trial court. Did she ever say, Judge, look, whether you look at the master deed or not, whether unanimity is required or not, at a minimum, you can't change the organizational structure without a vote, and under the bylaws, putting aside the master deed, there needs to be a two-thirds majority of the owners. That's what I was hunting for, is that the trial judge was given that argument and the trial judge said no to that, as opposed to the property regimen issue in the master deed.
I know, I was just reading the transcript a second ago to review it, and I know she repeatedly, I thought in the transcript, specifically argued that the owners were never given notice that the new articles of incorporation had ever been even adopted. She argued about the unanimity requirement in her argument. But I think if you look at her complaint, you take her complaint in the light most favorable to her, and all the inferences that flow from where she references the bylaws repeatedly and says that this new entity that was created, and that the ownership of the common elements, the foundation of the building she lives in, got transferred to some new entity that's not even referenced in land records. I think if you take all those inferences together, I think that argument flows necessarily and logically from that. I also think it's important to remember that Ms. Uplinger is also a pro se party in this situation, although she actually did a pretty good job, I think, for a pro se party in briefing this. I think the court has to remember that, too. You know, in the couple things I just want to say in response to what I think has been some of the legal shadow boxing that went on the other side here in terms of their brief. There's nothing in the law that prohibits an unincorporated association from incorporating, right? But you have to do it correctly. You just can't just announce to have an executive session meeting and then just come out and announce that we've just created some new legal entity and that everything is now a new entity without either taking a vote of the unincorporated association's members, without signing legal documents affecting a merger, without doing, you just can't, by fiat, do that. And so it's a process issue. It's not, nowhere did Ms. Uplinger ever argue they couldn't do this. What she argued is they didn't do it correctly, number one. Number two, it's important to note that when the board of directors did this, they granted themselves all kinds of new powers without ever going to the homeowners to get them, which is exactly opposite of constructing things in a manner that don't restrict property rights. They granted themselves broader indemnity provisions. They gave themselves new powers. The Non-Stock Corporation Act has all these additional powers that non-stock corporations have that were never granted in the original deed, that were never granted in the bylaws. If Your Honor want, I can list them off. Section 13.1826 of the code lists off all kinds of things like pensions and salaries and directors and officers, life insurance for directors, all kinds of things that a non-stock can do that were never granted. But they just gave themselves those powers without going to their owners. Number three, this keeps coming up in homeowner association cases across the state. And I would hope this court would make it crystal clear. I think the court kind of did in White v. Boundary and in Sully Station, the other prior homeowners cases. But a lot of the firms, the people who represent HOAs, seem to think that if something is silent, if a document, if a bylaw, if a declaration is silent, that that lack of restriction means they can do whatever they want. When in fact, it's the exact opposite way around when you're dealing with property owner associations or condo associations. These are entities that restrict property rights. And these powers, unless they're specifically granted in the declaration, unless the corporation, either the non-stock or the unincorporated association, is specifically granted a power by the owners in that document and land records, they don't have it. They just don't get it because the General Assembly maybe gave it to them or because the document was silent, so they by default get it. It's the opposite. Unless that power is expressly granted, they don't get it. The fourth thing is this idea that a referential definition versus a substantive definition. The appellees argue in this case that when the bylaws repeatedly reference an unincorporated association, that was just some sort of vague construct that they can slip anything into they want. If you construe that document strictly, when it says an unincorporated association, it means what it says. The property owners picked an unincorporated association to govern them. And that couldn't be changed unless the property owners made the decision to change that.
But the tougher question, at least for me, is whether or not you need unanimity or whether or not you need a two-thirds vote.
Well, either way, they didn't get either of that in this case. They didn't get anything. They just had an executive session. They didn't even announce to the membership they were going to have a meeting to consider this, which the Condo Act specifically requires. I mean, they couldn't have even decided somebody had the wrong color shutter paint on their house without giving notice to their members and saying, we're going to decide Ms. Uplinger's condo has the wrong flower pot out front. They have to give notice of that to the members, have an opportunity for them to come present, argue their case, have a hearing. They didn't do anything. They just went to executive session, came out one day and announced to the members, hey, we've created this new corporation that's going to own all of your foundation of your building. It's going to own all your common elements. Hope you like it. That isn't how it works. And, I think this court got all caught up in the fact that she was a pro se serial litigant and didn't want to read anything and just sort of threw the case out. That shouldn't be what had happened. The fifth thing I want to say is that I think the appellees were a little too clever in their brief. On page 23, they point out that one of the reasons this is okay is because it didn't change anything. It didn't change any of the rights and responsibilities between the members of the corporation. But then they go on to say, but it provides all these new benefits to the members. Now, I don't know how it could provide new benefits if it didn't change anything. It's either one or it isn't, right? And it could be that the members, when they adopted this organization, or the people that bought into this condo, wanted to live in a place that had an unincorporated association governing it. Maybe because that extra liability on directors gave them an incentive to behave. Maybe that might be a benefit to have an unincorporated association versus a non-stock corporation. But the owners were deprived of that choice because the board of directors just decided they were going to change it because it was good for them. It was a exactly textbook, self-centered decision made by a board of directors, you know, to breach their fiduciary duties, and it was aided and abetted by this law firm, which is also something that you're all, that this court, I think, needs to make clear. Because now there's legal confusion out there about whether or not in Virginia we have a cause of action for aiding and abetting a breach of fiduciary duty. This court has said it might exist. You know, if you prove the three elements, you might get there. The Fourth Circuit says it exists. There's a district court that says it exists. Some people say it doesn't exist. I think this court needs to make clear.
But isn't it a bit of a stretch to go after a law firm that, on the face of it, is just simply providing legal services? I mean, where's the limiting principle? Because it's an awful ambiguous doctrine if we were to adopt it, as you suggest.
Sure. Well, you know, I don't think this court has ever adopted the notion that law firms have complete immunity from the actions they take. And if that's the argument that's being made, you know, wouldn't be surprised if Michael Cohen was here ready to make it with me, or make it with them.
But there is something unique about the attorney-client relationship that's different from non-relationships that don't have the same confidentiality.
No, I appreciate that, but like, why don't you look at it this way? In the Halifax case, in which this court said that aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty might exist, that had to do with a bank, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why a bank. I mean, a bank could say the same thing. Hey, we were just processing checks. We were just doing our job at the bank. And our employee just, it's too bad our employee...
But we didn't say it did apply. We said even if it were to apply. So I mean, it's not like a hat tip that, yeah, we think it would apply to a bank.
Sure, but y'all could have said, this court could have said back then that, you know, the bank was just doing its job. They were doing routine banking services. They weren't really conspiring. It was just sort of a, you know, kind of a negligence thing. It wasn't really willful, you know. You know, I think I'm not sure what makes lawyers all that special when they are facilitating something they know they shouldn't have done. For example, one of the reasons we cited that they had intent that was that the law firm sent this email to the board that said, you need to incorporate because it'll protect you officers and directors from liability. They said if you create the non-stock, it'll protect you from personal liability. The Code of Virginia already says that HOA condo directors are immune. So, I mean, their advice was just wrong. You know, they're not protected because this code already says they are. So, I think that shows their intent to make money as attorneys by giving this type of advice to facilitate this transaction. I see my time has expired.
You have almost three minutes left. 2 minutes, 51 seconds.
Right, thank you.
Every bone.
Good morning, Maple Leafs Court. Joe Rainsbury for the Appleys, Alexandria Overlook, and LeClaire Ryan. Before I get started with my prepared argument, I want to respond to a few points made in Mr. Sturavel's opening presentation. First of all, this was a matter that was extensively briefed and argued. If you look at the joint appendix, there's 50 pages or 45 pages of oral argument on this, and there's about that many pages.
Do you think it is fair to say that the plaintiff below made the bylaws argument? That is, okay, Judge, even if unanimity is not required under the master deed, even if property regimen is not the fulcrum of the analysis, you can't change the entire structural organization without a vote. And the bylaws obviously require a two-thirds vote. That didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. In fact, the exact opposite happened. What she did, she told the court, in a briefing at least, expressly that she was not making a bylaws argument. She said at one point that she wasn't citing the bylaws. She was relying on a breach of paragraph 15 of the master deed. So she tells the circuit court that she was not making this argument, and then she comes to this court and makes exactly the same, argument.
Why did they make that decision without conducting a vote? I mean, how is it possible with legal counsel for them to have done that?
Well, if you look at Article 3 of the bylaws, that gives the board the power to do anything that is not otherwise required, either by statute or by the condominium instruments, to be done by the co-owners. So
so you can dispense with the two-thirds vote under that logic on every issue, including changing the very structure of the organization.
Not so. I mean, amendment of the bylaws is something that is expressly provided for, and it states that that must be done by a two-thirds vote.
Well, these bylaws were superseded in their entirety by the new structure. They weren't amended. They were just completely cast aside by a completely new corporate structure.
With respect, I don't think that's a fair characterization. If you look at the actual articles of incorporation, they're really just, it's a skeleton, articles of incorporation, that says the purpose of this corporation is to administer this condominium in accordance with the bylaws and in accordance with the master deed. So they're not one or the other. It's not that the article of incorporation superseded the bylaws.
So the association's bylaws are every bit, every sentence, every word of it, every bit operable now as they were prior to the corporation?
Yes. And, I mean, if you look at the Non-Stock Corporation Act, there's a provision that relates to property owners' associations, and it specifically says that for such organizations, the bylaws control as to things like voting, as to amending the bylaws, and as to disposition of property. So these are actually not, I mean, it's not an either-or scheme. These are sort of coordinate schemes. And really, all that incorporation did was provide a corporate wrapper on the existing organization, saying that we are now incorporated, we're entitled to the protection of unincorporated, non-stock corporations in Virginia. Other than that, everything else still applies. So, and, you know, I think it's important to look, because this is a demur, to look at the actual allegations in the amended complaint. In the amended complaint, plaintiff alleges that the board breached the master deed. It says nothing about breaching the bylaws. So count one alleges that the board breached the master deed by incorporating without first obtaining unanimous approval. There's nothing about two-thirds approval. It's all unanimous. You needed to obtain unanimous approval.
What do you do about the assertions in paragraph 12, 16, 50, and 51 of the bylaws being breached?
I don't believe that those say that the bylaws have been breached. And in any event, to the extent that there's any lack of clarity, Ms. Uplinger clarified the matter for us in the circuit court by saying, I'm not making that argument. What I'm alleging is a breach of Article 15 of the Master Deed. So if you look at paragraph 15 of the Master Deed, this basically says that you can't change the horizontal property regime without having a unanimous vote. And Ms. Uplinger construed that to mean that you can't incorporate. Well, I think it all hinges on what a horizontal property regime means. And that's made clear at the beginning of the Master Deed, where it talks about the regime being the Horizontal Property Act. So basically, what paragraph 15 says is that this property cannot stop being a condominium unless everybody agrees. And that makes perfect sense. But it says nothing about incorporation. And in fact, there's nothing inconsistent with the Condominium Act incorporating the Owners Association. The Condominium Act specifically says the Owners Association can be incorporated. So there's no violation of paragraph 15 of the Master Deed.
But Uplinger's not saying that it can't be incorporated. She's saying that you've got to vote, and people that are involved in the process need to have some participation, some, at least two-thirds.
Well, again, what she was saying in the trial court was that this was a breach of Article 15, or I'm sorry, paragraph 15 of the Master Deed, because there was not a unanimous vote. And she was not saying anything about a two-thirds vote.
If we give her the benefit of all the inferences, she does allege in her complaint in paragraph 71 that, again, referring to the Master Deed, she refers to paragraph 15 and she refers to paragraph 8. paragraph 8 in the master deed then refers to the bylaws. And at some point in her argument to the court around JA 479, she points out that she's not arguing about the change in the physical property, but what she is arguing is that the provisions of the Virginia Code that apply to the governance of Alexander Overlook have been violated. So if you string all of that together, paragraph 8 referring to the bylaws and her argument on 497, why isn't that enough to survive demur?
Well, I think in an ordinary case this would be, but if you look, but she has expressly told the trial court that she is not making that argument. She told the trial court in her brief, and I'll give you the reference, that she is not arguing that there was a violation of the amended bylaws. She's alleging that there was a breach of the master deed. So although you might be able to string together that, she has expressly rejected that argument, and she can't have it both ways. She cannot say to the trial court, I'm not making that argument, and then when her other argument doesn't fly, try to revive that on appeal by making the argument that she says she wasn't making.
But to the extent that the argument that the Overlook made to the circuit court was, well, she's talking about governance and she's talking about condominiums, her argument would equate to condominiums being changed to some other type of property. And she disavows that notion. Yes, at one point she seems to adopt it, but on 497, she seems to disavow it, not about a change in the organization of the physical property, but rather about the provisions of the Virginia Code that apply to the governance.
Well, to the extent that she's characterizing her argument that there's been a breach of paragraph 15 of the master deed, that's incorrect. I mean, she maybe has interpreted paragraph 15 of the master deed to apply to governance, but paragraph 15 applies to the horizontal property regime, and that means the status of the property as a condominium. So she's just confused about what paragraph 15 actually means. And I'd like to turn very briefly to the issue of sanctions. I think it's been the other side's position that there's just not enough evidence. There should have been a trial or an evidentiary hearing on this matter. Well, they never made that argument below, and there was actually evidence in this case. We attached several affidavits from her neighbors talking about the harm that her multiple lawsuits have caused.
Really address in your sanctions argument the merits or demerits of her specific legal analysis. And maybe the property regimen argument out of the master deed was a loser, but maybe the bylaws argument was a clear winner. And the issue is whether or not it was half preserved, fully preserved, or not preserved. That's not a sanctionable question. That's just a figure it out question.
Right. Well, we submit first that it was not a reasonable argument, she was looking for a fight.
It's not a reasonable argument that if you're a member of an unincorporated association, that a handful of people who are your agents can convert it to a completely different corporate structure without notice, without vote, and in violation of a two-thirds requirement in the bylaws. That's an unreasonable position.
We submit that the argument that she makes in the amended complaint, which is that there was a violation of paragraph 15 of the master deed,
No, I'm not
was
talking about that. I'm talking about the bylaws.
Well, and frankly, I submit that it's unreasonable for a member of a non-stock corporation to think that, you know, the board can't incorporate. I mean, if you're a member of a club.
Well, the association incorporates. The board doesn't do anything. The board acts as a representative of the underlying stakeholders.
Right. Well, the board acts as the association, and it's been given that authority by the bylaws. But even setting aside that, Your Honor, if you look at 271.1, it doesn't have to be unreasonable and for an improper purpose. It's either or. And this court has recently held that even a pro se litigant who has a string of non-meritorious lawsuits and has shown a pattern of bringing non-meritorious lawsuits, you can infer an improper intent. And not only that, I mean, this is not the first time that Ms. Upplinger has appeared before the circuit court. The circuit court was familiar with her.
And under our case law, the circuit court's ability to take judicial notice of its own records is limited. And so, and here we're talking about judicial notice of federal lawsuits in part, right? So how does the circuit, I mean, there's plenty of litigants who file lots of lawsuits.
Well, this is not really a case of judicial notice. There were affidavits discussing the prior litigation history. I mean, these are statements under oath by her neighbors.
Were they subject to cross-examination?
Well, they're made under oath under penalty of perjury, and there was no objection to the introduction of these as evidence. And if she had objected and demanded them to appear for cross-examination, we would have been happy to bring them. But there was ample evidence in this case of the harm that this woman's lawsuits have caused to her neighbors. And these lawsuits have been over relatively trivial things. I mean, in the present case, incorporation provided benefits to the owners. I mean, it provided an additional shield from individual liability. And it's unclear what beef Ms. Upplinger has actually with incorporation. But these are basically frivolous lawsuits, but the consequences have been severe. I mean, this is a relatively small condominium.
And the way I know those previous lawsuits are frivolous is based on these affidavits?
Because
if you come in with a memorandum opinion or a certified copy of the record and you say, oh, this is what happened, and you can see it's totally frivolous, then okay, I have some basis to know that judicial proceeding was groundless. This seems to me a little different.
Well, the record shows that she's filed, I think, upwards of 20 cases, and none of them have succeeded. And in the present case, I think I want to emphasize the harm that these have caused to our neighbors. This is a small condominium. I mean, this is, say, I think, maybe about 80 units.
You may be absolutely right, but what I'm struggling with is how you prove that. So maybe there's a serial litigant filing frivolous lawsuits all day long, but you still have to show that was the case, as opposed to, well, she filed the lawsuits, they didn't work out.
I don't think that this court's jurisprudence on serial pro se litigants demands a trial within a trial of all of the cases that the litigant has brought. And that's a pretty onerous standard. And regardless, I see that my time has expired.
You may answer the question.
Sure. Regardless of any proof or non-proof of the merits of those claims, there's ample additional evidence of the harm that these lawsuits have caused to her neighbors, costing the property association tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and of the malicious intent in bringing these lawsuits against the board.
All right, your time has expired.
All right, thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points I want to hit in response. Number one, in terms of the sanctions issues, let that first get an expression in everybody's mind. There's no record of this. The affidavits were never offered in evidence. She never had an opportunity to object. They weren't offered in evidence. They weren't marked as evidence. They were attached to some memo, and the appellee acts like that's evidence. That's not evidence. That's just something attached on a memo. And I don't think the court can just assume that those affidavits were part of the record the court considered in making sanctions, and they weren't offered. She was never given an opportunity to object, number one. Number two, on the sanctions, on this non-meritorious lawsuit idea, there was no record of that presented. There was no orders presented. There was no complaint presented. There's no memorandum opinion presented. There's no transcript shown. I don't even remember there being 20 alleged. I thought there were 7 or 9, many of which ended in a non-suit, which this court has found is specifically not a prevailing party situation by law. So it's not clear to me why a bunch of non-suits necessarily equates to frivolous lawsuits.
May I take you back, though, to the question of bylaws versus master deed?
Sure.
In her brief at JA 459, she says that she, quote, does not even refer to the Alexandria Overlook bylaws or an allegation set forth in count one, but rather states that the master deed was violated when Alexandria Overlook became incorporated without obtaining unanimous consent of the co-owners and usurped their voting rights. Then on 462, she says, quote, unfortunately for the defendants, Uplinger's first amended complaint does not include any assertions at all that Alexandria Overlook's amended bylaws required the council to remain an unincorporated entity. So we got two things we've got to figure out. One is, did the complaint allege enough to infer a bylaw theory? And let's say you win that for the sake of argument. The next question is his point, which is, if I were a trial judge hearing that or reading that, I think I would walk away thinking, okay, that's off the table. She's taken that off the table. I don't think I would spend 20, 30 minutes talking about it.
Well, Justice Kelsey, I'll direct you to the complaint, amended complaint, starting on the...
I'm with you. To save time, I'm with you on that in terms of understanding how, as Justice Powell was suggesting, it's possible to infer a bylaws theory out of the amended complaint in theory. My question is, doesn't the plaintiff tell the trial judge, I'm not making that argument? Whether you see it in the complaint or infer it or not, I'm not making it.
Well, I would just appreciate your being with me. Just note paragraphs 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, and 28 all talk about bylaw violations.
Yeah.
And
then why does she tell the trial judge, I'm not making a bylaw?
I think what her argument was is that the bylaw is incorporated through the master deed, and she was confusing the master deed with, I think she sort of saw them all as one thing, but the master deed was the governing document, and that she clearly says in the complaint that the bylaws define the entity as the unincorporated entity. So, you have to sort of think, view it through the lens of her being a pro se, and I know, she doesn't get the full benefit of the doubt for that, but that's that's what it says. Secondly, I would say...
Has he answered your question, Justice Kelsey?
Yes.
Yep.
All right, your time has expired.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case.